Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on rationing when we come back. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of the income tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%. And the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. You know, back in 1913, the average family worked through January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. But this year, we Americans had to work all the way through May 12th. In order to earn enough to pay our federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us today? Now, this income tax and social security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. This income tax and social security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and social security is the eighth plank. Now, that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? If you'd like more information, why don't you call us here at the law school and ask for our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. The number to call is 417-273-4967. And once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Our tax and status school is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for the free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about rationing. Rationing, coming to a city near you. Probably not this year, 2008. That's bad for the election. Well, it's bad for the Republicans for the election, but you know there isn't anything that's going to change that. The Republicans are, the president, the last time I saw a number, his approval rating was 28% and Congress was 18%. And now with approval ratings like that, I would expect that all of the Republican and Democratic candidates for office would be defeated. And Libertarian and Constitutional and other for a splinter party candidates would be elected en masse. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think what we're going to see here is a big blowout like we saw in 1932. And a socialist government put in place. Now, the government that we have is socialist. This Republican government that we now have. I mean, we call this guy George Bush a conservative. I don't think that Americans that were raised on Sesame Street and Barney and Big Bird and Mr. Rogers know what conservative means. I think it's beyond that. So in 1932, when the Democrats came into office, they instituted new reforms. They instituted change, top to bottom. And they introduced us to communism, all 10 planks. By the time Roosevelt was completed, by 1936, his first term, he had converted America to communism, all 10 planks. Now, that being the case, I would submit to you that by the time we get through with our first Democratic administration, if it goes that far, I think that you're going to have a gun control, you're going to have a health care, you'll have socialized medicine, you'll have every social program that the communists could dream up. And, of course, that's all bad. It's never worked anyplace else in the world where it's been tried. And it's always failed in the past, and I suspect that it's going to fail here. So if you can think about the worst possible solution to the problem, and then you're wondering, well, what the outcome is going to be or what's the future hold, you can rest assured that the worst possible solution will be that solution enacted by Congress and the President of the United States. All right. So wherever you live in the world, I don't care whether it's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Western Europe, you know, South Korea, Japan, your government is going to opt for what is popular. What makes everybody feel real good, and rationing is it. Now, you don't need rationing. What you need is more production. See, rationing is the system where we share the shortage. Well, hell, shortage isn't the optimum. Shortage isn't what we're after. Abundance is what we want. See, I can remember when there was so much gasoline in America, they had price wars. One station would cut the price by a penny. Then the next station would cut the price by 2 pennies, and the next 3 pennies, and so on. Until one time, the cheapest I saw it, I mean, after World War II, the cheapest I saw it was 24 cents a gallon at Mooney and Salachie's Richfield Station in Burndale. 24 cents a gallon. That was about 1957, 58, something like that. Now, that's where we want to go again. Now, we could do that. I mean, there's plenty of oil in the world. We've reached peak oil, but it's political peak oil. We haven't reached physical peak oil. I pointed that out to you in a few programs back. It's been a few weeks now. But there's 14 trillion barrels of oil available in the world. Well, now, the world's using 32 billion barrels a year worldwide. Right now, today, 32 billion barrels a year. America uses about six. And there's 14 trillion barrels. So if you take 14,000 and divide that by 32, that's a 437-year supply before you hit peak oil. And that's what you can burn up. Okay, now, that being the case, you know, we haven't burned up all the fuel that's available here on the planet. Now, that's what they admit to. That's what they know about. All right. But you're going to have rationing here pretty shortly. Now, rationing is a part and parcel with monopoly. And it was John D. Rockefeller that made this famous quotation. He said that competition is a sin. Competition is a sin. He was a monopolist. Now, a monopoly comes from top-down administration, top-down 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, five-year plan type administration. The opposite to that is the Ten Commandment, bottom-up free marketplace administration. In the free marketplace administration, back in the 50s, anybody who wanted to drill an oil well could drill an oil well. Hell, I could have drilled an oil well. Now, today, that's no longer true. See, Congress came in under the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and ecology, and they've passed all kinds of laws. Hell, you got to have an environmental impact statement. That costs $1 million now. Before you can drill an oil well in your backyard, you got to spend $1 million. Well, hell, if you had $1 million, you wouldn't need to drill the oil well, would you? I mean, that's just kind of where it's at. Us poor people are bottom feeders out here. The reason we want to drill oil wells is so that we can make $1 million. Now, that being the case, the monopolists are in control, and the monopolists are going to give us rationing, because that's where the money's at for the monopolists. That's not where the lifestyle is for you and me, but, you know, that's, since when did the politicians or the big businesses ever do anything that benefited the bottom feeders? I mean, you know, they're working for themselves, and then we can all understand that. It makes all the sense in the world. So I said, well, we got to have a solution. Us little guys down here at the bottom, you know, we got to have a solution for this rationing. And World War II had rationing, and World War II had solutions to the rationing. It's called the black market. Black market. That black market is, in reality, the free marketplace. It's the Ten Commandment model, and it works wherever it's tried. And I've pointed this out. You take marijuana. The biggest dollar-producing crop in America is marijuana. No price supports, no government subsidies. The government's working against the marijuana farmers. They don't get fertilizer subsidies or anything else. And furthermore, if they get caught growing their crop, they'll be put in jail. In spite of all of those obstacles and handicaps, they produce more dollars worth of marijuana than you wheat farmers, corn farmers, cotton farmers, and soybean farmers. How do you like that? So let me tell you, the marketplace, whether it's called the black market, the free market, supply and demand, it works. It works. It's been working for thousands of years, and it'll be working when the monopolists are dead and buried, like John D. Rockefeller. So the free marketplace, though, is going to be ridiculed and impugned. It'll be outlawed. It'll be marginalized. It'll be illegal. I just wanted to tell you that up front. But it'll be there, and it'll be working, and it'll provide everything you want. For instance, in Kosovo, during that war over there back in 1995, gasoline was $20 a gallon, and coffee was $4 a cup. And there was no shortage of gasoline and no shortage of coffee. And there's no shortage of heroin, there's no shortage of cocaine, and there's no shortage of marijuana. And the marketplace dictates the price, and the marketplace rations. See, the marketplace is the place for rationing, and if you don't want to put up with the rationing in the marketplace, you produce it yourself. Very simple. When we're talking about food and the high cost of food in the supermarket, what we do is we go plant a garden, and we produce all of our own food, and we don't buy anything from the supermarket at all. Let me give you an illustration of this. Some years back, I was buying coffee, and I had, at the time, put about 200 cans of coffee on my shelves. Then there was a price spike. It went from $4.50 a can to around $7.50 suddenly. I stopped buying. I didn't need to buy any because I already had a 12 or 15-year supply. Now, over time, the price of coffee spiked, and then it went back down. But boy, did people complain about that. And I thought to myself at the time, I said, well, now, when there was no shortage of coffee, nobody prepared. Nobody could look forward into the future and say, gosh, one of these days the monopolists, because they have a monopoly on coffee, and you cannot grow coffee in your backyard in North Dakota. And they're gonna bump up the price of coffee. They always do. Just like gasoline today, they bumped it up. You know, they always do. And you and I can't produce it. And so they got us over a barrel, say. Unless, of course, you got some other means, you know. Now, for instance, here I have propane in my tank, and I cook with it and heat my water. But I have an alternative source. I have wood. I live on a farm, and I've got a woodlot. And I cut my own wood, and if push ever comes to shove, I'll just tell them to take that propane and shove it and stick it where there's no daylight, and I'll burn wood, because I've got a wood cook stove, and I can heat my water on a wood cook stove. Now, I don't want to do that. Honest to God, I don't want to do that. But, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And I like, you know, I like the industrial model. It's just that the industrial model can't feed 6 billion people, and I don't want to be one of those that starves. So instead of standing in line at the food bank, what you need to be doing is standing out in your garden planting more. You see, the food bank, all that does is they go out into the marketplace with dollars and buy the available food and then give it to the poor. It does not produce one new tomato. It does not produce one added pepper or potato. It produces nothing, and it consumes much. All the food bank is a system of rationing, where we take donations from the rich, go out into the marketplace and buy up the scarce commodity, food, and then we give it to the poor. As time progresses, the rich people over here won't have enough money to do that. As the shortages grow and develop, then the rich people will stop giving money to the food banks to give to the poor. Then what are the poor going to do? They're going to do without, because whatever food's available is going to be reserved to the rich, because the rich have the money to bid the price up. It's always a bidding war over money. So the poor people, as they develop, there will be more and more of them, and they will howl and they will cry out to their God, the Congress of the United States. And their God will hear their cries, their prayers. And they will institute rationing. And here's the way that game has to be played. Let's suppose that there's a shortage, you know, just for the sake of our discussion here, of meat. Now, instead of rationing the meat by price like we do Rolls-Royce automobiles, see, Rolls-Royce automobiles are rationed by price. And I don't have one. And I'm probably never going to have a Rolls-Royce, probably. And that's because they cost $200,000. Now, the monopolists, they drive Rolls-Royces. But us guys, we drive Volkswagens, Chevrolets, and Yugos. So let's suppose that there's a shortage of meat now, and you guys are just crying out, you know, to your God. Well, they'll put on meat rationing. Now, there won't be any meat rationing for George Gordon, because I'm a net producer of meat. But when I go to sell my meat, there will be a price. I'll have to sell my cows over here at the auction barn, and the price will be 69 cents a pound. The fact that it costs 79 cents a pound to produce the beef is irrelevant. Politicians, you know, don't balance books. Politicians, you know, they don't pay payrolls. Politicians don't produce anything. They produce nothing and consume much and get in the way of those of us that do produce. So the fact that there's a 10-cent deficit, let me tell you this. If I have to sell my cows for 69 cents a pound and it costs me 79 cents a pound to produce them, let me tell you what I'm going to do with my cows. I'm going to gut shoot them and let them die and feed the coyotes. And that's just where reality is at. Then I'm not even going to produce any. I won't even put the bull out with the cows. And then what animals I have left, I will dispose of. And I will produce no beef at all. Now, for openers, that isn't the way the game is played for openers. They'll start off for openers, and they'll say, okay, we're going to have rationing 79 cents a pound for the 69-cent beef. So I'm going to be making 10 cents a pound, but I'm locked into that 10 cents. And then as inflation continues on, it'll be 9 cents, 8 cents, 7 cents, 6 cents, 5 cents, 4 cents, you say. Now, that's the way the politician gets the farmer to work longer, harder, and produce more. It's by squeezing his margin. So the farmer says, well, let's see. I was producing 100 cows, and I was getting 10 cents a pound. Now, my margin's down to 5 cents, so now I need to produce 200 so that I can have the same standard of living. So the farmer goes out and produces twice as much. It's a ruse that's been used on us for the last 75 years. Worked like a shot. I don't deny it. Work well. Inflation, squeezing margins, works well. But there comes a point of diminishing returns, and I pointed that out to you. If you're making $50,000 a year and the government's, you know, taking 30 of it, leaving you with 20, I said, well, go out with your heavy progressive income tax and produce $100,000 next year, and then you'll get to keep $25,000. The government will get 75. So instead of the government taking 60%, they boost their share up to 75%. And you, instead of making, you know, the 20% that's left, you know, the $20,000 that's left, you know, your percentage drops down. You're going to make $5,000 more. If you produce twice as much, you make $5,000 more. But you got to produce twice as much to do that. Pretty soon you get to this diminishing return thing again, like you have in New York City with your rental properties. You got price controls and rent controls. And so nobody spends any money fixing up those properties. And so they just the infrastructure degenerates. And you produce less and less. And that's the story I told you about last time with Zimbabwe. Remember? Zimbabwe. So as inflation continues, they're on a cash basis. They can't get gasoline because they got to pay for it with foreign reserves. They can't produce the foreign reserves because they're only exporting X amount, and the amount that they're exporting is far less than the amount that they need to import to feed all those people, produce gasoline, and a standard of living. And that's what's coming to the United States. So let me tell you the answer to this. The last thing you want is political rationing. What you really want is economic rationing. Economic rationing, which is where you're at with $6 gasoline. If the marketplace is left alone and allowed to run its course, when gasoline gets to $6, $8, $10, $15, $20, $60 a gallon, let me assure you that people will not be burning gasoline in their cars, and other people will be coming up with other transportation inventions like hydrogen or electric or something else to take its place. So let the oil companies and let the oil sheiks have their way. Let the marketplace take the money and come up with a solution to the problem. Now, let me tell you, here in the United States, they just discovered out in Montana 40 billion barrels of oil. Well, listen, boys and girls, we Americans use 6 billion. They found 40 divided by 6. Now, that's a six-year supply. That's in western Montana. Well, you people aren't drilling for oil out in western Montana. Over in North Dakota, they discovered 500 billion barrels. Well, 500 divided by 6 is an 83-year supply. Now, we haven't talked about that 3 trillion barrels that we got down there in Wyoming over in Four Corners, you know, over in the Wyoming and Utah, called the oil shale. Now, when the price of oil, you know, gets up to $6 a gallon, it'll make that oil shale very, very competitive. Very competitive. And that's what we should have been doing all along. We never should have gone into this, let's import it from Saudi Arabia and run up these huge deficits and go into debt. That was the monopolist that came up with that plan, with that idea. See, you were so busy going to, you know, to Princess Cruises and Disneyland and Disney World and living the good life that you weren't paying attention when these policy decisions were being made back in 1972, 73, when Nixon took us off of the gold standard. Remember gold payments? Yeah, you people weren't paying attention. We went on to fiat currency. We're now headed to fiat currency hell. That's where we're headed. And you were out busy voting, all right, but you didn't pay attention to who you were voting for, and the people you were voting for brought you more and more of this socialism and more of this industrial agriculture, which ultimately was unsustainable and had an ultimate net end result. And here we are, boys and girls, with the net end result, shortages. Now, for right now, you Americans and Canadians and Australians can say, yeah, but we got the money and we can bid the price up and we'll take it away from those Haitians and Dominicans and the Pakistanis and the Bangladeshis and so on and let those guys starve. Well, okay, that's fine. That'll work for a while. But you want to remember that that's where all the rice is produced. And those countries over there now have come up to a conclusion they're not going to export any. Now, I reported this a little earlier. Now, I'm going to report it again. Down in Australia, they used to have a pretty good-sized rice-producing industry down there, but they just closed down their big rice mill because they've lost 96% of their production. See, you Australians are now producing 4% of the rice that you used to produce. Well, that's not good. That's not good at all. What we need to do is produce more rice. We don't need to share the shortage and bid up the prices. We need to produce more. And to encourage people to produce more, you want the price of beef to go to $1, $2, $3 a pound. And then I will put on more and more cows. I will produce my heart. I will go out because I'm greedy. And that motivates my greed button. And I'll go out and produce more, and then pretty soon you'll have a glut of meat on the market, and that glut of meat will force the price down. Because then how am I going to get rid of it? I've got to lower the price. Why would you pay me $3 a pound for meat that you can get same quality for two? I mean, that's just where reality's at. Why would we spend $6 a gallon for gas when we can buy hydrogen fuel for $2 a gallon? So wouldn't you buy a hydrogen car? Wouldn't you buy an electric car? Wouldn't you buy a hybrid car? I mean, you know, that's where it's headed. But that isn't what's going to happen. Oh, no, that's, if you think that the marketplace is going to come in and solve your problem for you and bring you back to abundance, you got your head up the wrong end, Jane. Pay attention, Betty. Listen to this. Long before the marketplace can actually work, you will have rationing. And then the oil companies will produce less and less of it. So you're going to have less and less of the product at the same price. So they will continue to produce out of those fields where the set price and will still make a profit. But they will produce less and less. Let me show you how that works. While the run-up of gas is going on, you'd think that the oil companies would be out there just producing like crazy so they could sell into the marketplace. No, you don't understand business. Let me show you how this works. I just had a student blow in here last week. He's moving from Montana. While he's moving from Montana, he drives through Wyoming. Wyoming has a lot of oil wells. And he said about 6 out of every 7 oil wells, he was out counting them, 6 out of every 7 oil wells is shut down. You know, and I said to the guy, I said, that's exactly what I saw in 1973 and in 1978. When there was an oil crisis, the oil wells in Wyoming were shut down. You'd think that they'd be out there just pumping their hearts out. No. See, the big oil companies own all those now. That used to be when there was little guys, little bottom feeders like you and me, that owned those oil wells, we'd be out there pumping like crazy. We used to produce 17% of our oil out of stripper wells. Stripper wells. That's wells that produce a barrel, 10 barrels, 20 barrels a week. Well, now all of those oil wells have been closed down and sealed up, closed off. They're out of production. That exacerbates your shortage. That exacerbates your price rise. Doesn't solve your problem. See, what you need is more production. So at the same time, the oil companies are out here encouraging the environmentalists to discourage any drilling in Alaska. Now, we don't know how much oil is in Alaska, but based upon what we've seen so far, there's probably more oil in Alaska than there is in Saudi Arabia. We don't want to drill for oil in Alaska. My God, you know, the oil companies learned from that back in the 1950s when they had the bottom-up Ten Commandment model. The monopolists learned that with all of those little producers out there producing oil, they couldn't monopolize the price, and the price dropped to 24 cents a gallon. So, you know, you don't have to be real smart to figure out what we got to do is create a shortage. And the way you create a shortage is to get rid of all the little competitors. So they did. They went to the Congress, and they passed laws, environmental laws, real nice laws, the kind of laws that all you people voted for and you wanted. You got what you wanted, environmental laws. So we're not out here. Little guys like George Gordon are not out here polluting the environment. Okay? But we're not out here producing any oil either, and that's why you're paying $6 a gallon. Well, you're going to shortly, coming to a city near you. All right, now, that's what happened in oil past tense, and that's what's happening with food now present tense. So, you know, a shark like myself, bottom feeding shark, I look around and say, well, where are the opportunities for business? I can't think of a better business than food in a famine. And the world is headed for famine. Why? Because the monopolists are in control of the Congress, the oil companies. Now, you people are real mad now, and you're going to vote in the Democrats. Well, now you're going to have socialist monopolists in the Congress instead of the greedy capitalist monopolists. You're not going to change much. And now your people tell me, get out and vote. Get out and vote. Boys and girls, it hasn't dawned on us yet that voting is our problem. You see, if voting was the solution to the problem, you wouldn't have a problem because you've been voting for the last 225 years. You've been voting for 225 years, and here's the problem. It's obvious that the voting didn't prevent the problem. So now I'm watching the TV, and the boob tube says, get out and vote. Get out and vote. Get out and vote. Well, okay. But if voting hasn't prevented the problem, what in the hell makes us think that voting is going to solve the problem over the next 30, 60, or 90 days? Huh? Or the next 30, 60, or 90 years, for that matter. Hang on, I've got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour. An editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet worldwide. Now, for more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the law our website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about rationing. Now, if you can figure a predictable course of action that government's going to follow, they're going to do what they did in the past. Now, during World War II, there was this great need for rationing. Well, that's what we were told. But come to find out, there wasn't any shortage of gasoline in World War II, at least not here in the United States. And there wasn't any shortage of food in Australia. Let me give you an illustration here. Here's Australia. Australians were lightly rationed compared to the other combatants during World War II. The basis for rationing in all countries which conducted it was to equalize the food supply and to reduce inflation and the malign grip of a black market. Black market, you can translate that into a free market enterprise, you know, price, supply and demand. The malign grip of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, must be thwarted at all costs. All right, now the policymakers were influenced by the British example of rationing, but they never had to institute such draconian measures that the British Ministry of Food had to administer. Here in Australia, rationing was introduced to ensure civilians did not hoard valuable resources. There's that bad word, hoard. We don't want to be hoarders. I'll underline that. Valuable resources to be certain that Australian servicemen were fed adequately. Although Army food requires a paper to itself to fulfill trade agreements with the British government and to provide for the American servicemen stationed here, rationing was not the result of scarcity, but more the result of planning needed to feed so many extra mouths. Glut, especially with fruits, was an unforeseen problem. The British no longer accepted fruit imports because the nutritional value of apples, for example, and pears, was not as high as meat and cheese, and the product took too much space in valuable shipping. So in Western Australia, for example, apple orchards were pulled out and apples were fed to the pigs. A local juice was prepared. Competitions were mounted for recipes to use the fruit, but the problem did not disappear until the Americans declared their fondness for apple pies. All right, so in Australia, for instance, in World War II, apples and pears were a glut on the market. And it made all the sense in the world. See, the British, who were fighting the war right across the channel, the Germans were sinking their ships just as fast as they could. So the British, they said, well, we've got valuable shipping space, and we don't want to clutter it up with apples. We want to clutter it up with meat and cheese. This left the Australians then sitting there with all their apples and pears. What are we going to do with them? Well, feed them to the Americans. Feed them to the pigs. Pull out the apple orchards. Nobody wants to buy them. And that's what happens when you institute rationing. We pull out the apple orchards. I told you that earlier. I said, go ahead. Stick me with rationing, and all I'm going to do is kill all my animals, and I'm not going to produce any more meat. Rationing, when you impose political rationing, it makes the shortage more severe, which jacks the price up, which is what the monopolists want. Well, isn't that just special? Now let's try rationing in Mexico City. A ban restricting each car from driving on a specified weekday is found to have increased total driving in Mexico City. Now, there's too many cars in Mexico City, and there's too many people driving too many cars up and down the streets of Mexico City. So the politicians come along and say, well, what we need is a plan. Let's ration it. Okay, so what happens? Well, here's what happens. Because of this ban, cars effectively represent driving permits, and some households have bought an additional car and increased their driving. Greater use of old cars, congestion effects, and increased weekend driving may also have contributed to the disappointing results. The ban has high welfare costs, and it does not deliver the intended benefits of reducing driving. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. This experience provides an interesting lesson in applied welfare economics. Theory indicates that this is a costly way of reducing traffic and pollution, but the finding that the strategy is counterproductive could be made only with applied quantitative analysis. Well, that means that you've got to put this thing into the marketplace and test it for a while and see what the results are going to be. But every time that rationing is imposed from the top down in this political model, it always fails. It fails each and every time, and it exacerbates the problem. The shelves go bare, and a black market ensues because the free marketplace is the real balancing test of the value of the product in the market. And that's where reality is at. Divorced from Barney, Mr. Rogers, and Sesame Street, that's where reality is located. All right, now with that in mind, then, here's what happened in World War II. My uncle Lloyd was a fisherman in World War II. They imposed gasoline rationing. Now, gasoline refineries have to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, in order to do that, you have to have a certain amount of feedstock coming in. You can increase the feedstock, and then you can produce more, but if you produce more gasoline, for example, what are you going to do with it? While the oil is in the ground, it's not a problem. But as soon as you pull it out of the ground, it becomes a problem because it plugs up the transportation system. It's in the holds of ships. It's in the pipelines. It's in the storage tanks. So once you have turned this oil into gasoline, you got to put it into a storage tank. Well, pretty soon all the storage tanks are full. So my Uncle Lloyd reported to me when I was a little kid. This is right after World War II. I'm just a little kid. He said there was no gasoline shortage in the war because the surplus gas, that they didn't have a place to put it, they loaded on barges and they hauled it out into the Pacific Ocean. and to keep it out of the shipping lanes so that nobody would see what was going on, they hauled it north, 200 miles off the coast of Crescent City in Eureka, California. Dumped it out into the orchard, out into the ocean, and they lit it off and burned it on top of the ocean. All of the surplus gasoline. Now, they did it for a reason. They wanted the people at home to do without, to suffer, so that they would know that there was a war going on. See, today, Americans don't know there's a war going on in Iraq. If you were doing without gasoline, if you had rationing here, see, that doesn't bode well, you know, for a war. So the bottom line was that there was just god-awful waste is what it boils down to. We had plenty for the war. We had plenty for the civilian population, but we went out and burned it. All right, now that's one example. Then my uncle Leroy, he came back from the war in Korea, and so we were there talking, a little older now, teenager, and he said, well, when the aircraft carrier, he was on an aircraft carrier, he says, when the aircraft carrier comes back into port, they take all the food and dump it over the fantail. They take all the gasoline and dump it off into the ocean. They fly it up with all kinds of flights. They do everything they can to get rid of the gasoline, to get rid of the food and all the supplies on board the ship so they can put all new supplies on. Well, this is why you have $600 hammers. Now, instead of taking that food and dumping it over the fantail, why don't they bring it home and feed it to the poor? God, can you people ever wake up and pay attention? If you brought all that stuff home and you gave it to the poor, it would drive the price down. Monopolists don't want lower prices. They want higher prices. We don't want 24-cent gasoline, kids. We want $6 gasoline. In order to have $6 gasoline, we got to have a shortage. Even if there isn't a physical shortage, we have to have a political shortage. Rationing is the modality by which we create this physical shortage. Now, this poses a real dilemma, a real problem, because we've got an industrial agriculture that's been put into place. And the industrial agriculture is going to bring about famine worldwide in the best of circumstances. Now, once it starts and we introduce rationing, it's going to exacerbate the shortage. Let me show you another example. In World War II, they rationed cigarettes. The theory behind it was, well, the servicemen have to have cigarettes first. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, but those servicemen that were fighting the war over in Europe were smoking when they were in New York and West Virginia and California, weren't they? Well, what difference does it make whether they're smoking in France or smoking in New York? They're still smoking. So the argument that we need to ration tobacco so that the servicemen can have the tobacco is nonsense. Here's what the rationing did. People who did not smoke went down and signed up for the cigarette ration. Now, at the peak of smoking, only half the people of America smoked. And there was no shortage of tobacco in 1939. The shortage of tobacco occurred in 1942, 3, and 4 when we rationed it. You see, when you outlaw something, it's a form of rationing. When you outlaw marijuana, you ration it. So you decrease the amount and the price goes up. That's why marijuana sells for more than tobacco. If you didn't outlaw marijuana, it would be selling at the same price as, or it would be competing with tobacco. Probably more people would prefer to smoke marijuana than they would to smoke L&M's or Winston or Marlboro's. So you can rest assured that as long as there is a tobacco industry, there will be laws against marijuana. The tobacco industry does not want marijuana as a competitor any more than Exxon wants Joe Sixpack drilling oil wells in Texas as a competitor. That's why we have the Environmental Protection Agency. The Environmental Protection Agency doesn't have anything to do with protecting your environment. It has to do with the protection of the profits of ExxonMobil and Standard Oil and Shell Oil Company. All right, so that being the case, then let's figure out, well, how do we profit from the impending famine? I'm not for famine. I'm against it. I think we should be practicing the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandment model. But we're not doing that now. We didn't do it in the past, and we're not going to do it in the future. We are going to practice the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. We are going to practice industrial agriculture, and we're going to have shortages, and we're going to have famines. And I'm just sitting here saying, well, how am I going to profit from that? And like I said before, I can't think of a better business to be in than food and famine. So when the tobacco was rationed, everybody went down and signed up for the rations. This doubled the demand and made a real shortage. Now there's only half as much because instead of half the people of America smoking, you got 100% of the people of America. They're not smoking, but they're down there getting the cigarettes. And that's because now they use those cigarettes, and they use the cigarettes as a bartering chip to trade for gasoline. Now, things that were rationed were things like sugar, gasoline, tobacco. All right, picture it this way. Let's suppose you're a vegetarian. Hell, you're not buying meat today. You're not depreciating the amount of meat that's available for us meat eaters. But the minute that the Congress puts on on meat and price controls, all of you vegetarians will go down and sign up to get your ration card to get your full ration of meat. Well, when you do that, it freezes the price, and I'm going to stop producing meat, which is going to create a real physical shortage. See how that works? Rationing doesn't have anything to do with producing more. Rationing has to do with producing less to force prices even higher. You think you got high prices with $4 gasoline, you wait until you ration. Now, that's what you people are going to scream for and cry for, and that's what you're going to get. And then we'll have $8 and $10 gasoline with a ration card, which accomplishes the same thing that the marketplace would do. Now, if you have a free marketplace and you just let anybody drill for oil that wants to, any place that they can get a lease to drill, you'll have more oil than you know what to do with. And that's why you're going to have the Environmental Protection Agency, and that's why you're going to have these greenie movements going. And get this, the biggest single contributor to the Sierra Club is Atlantic Richfield, Richfield Oil Company. Why? Well, because the greenies say don't drill for oil in Alaska. Let me ask you a question here. When was the last time you went up to the Anwar National Preserve? Let me ask you a second question. Can you put your finger on the Anwar National Preserve on a map? Could you find it on a map? Have you ever heard of the Anwar National Preserve? And it's the Arctic Wilderness, AAW, Arctic Wilderness Reserve Area or something. I forgot what the acronym is, but it's up on the north coast of Alaska, up on the Arctic Ocean. Now you know where it's at. There's a few hundred Eskimos that live up there. And there's, they went up there and explored for oil, and they found 6 billion barrels. We don't know how much oil is up there because, you know, after you find 6 billion barrels, why would you want to spend money and find 12, 24, or 48 billion barrels? I mean, you know, we spent the money on 6, and we can't drill for the 6 that's there, so why? And so what the presidential contenders say, well, there's only 6 billion barrels. That's only enough to run our country for a year. And so they say to us, well, obviously, we can't solve the energy problem by drilling oil wells. Excuse me. When we had 24-cent gasoline, we had lots of oil wells and lots of drilling going on. If you want to have lots of oil, you got to drill lots of oil wells. Well, unless, of course, you've been watching Barney and Sesame Street. Well, that's just where reality's at. So let's just face the reality and smell the coffee. Now, I have never been up there, and I don't ever intend to go there, and I don't give a rat's ass if they were to drill oil wells up there and pollute the whole damn thing. I don't care. It's irrelevant to me. But I'll give you greenies this. I'll say, well, it makes sense to me that when you drill, that we ought not to just go up there and destroy it for the sake of destroying it. So I'm all in favor of the greenies and the environmental laws. I'm all in favor of it. But see, the environmentalists aren't in favor of environmental laws. They want to carry it a step further, and they want to abolish all drilling altogether. So they're not in favor of moderation. They're in favor of abstinence. But you know, those people, they burn electricity just like I do and you do and everybody else, and they burn gasoline in their cars just like you and I and everybody else. But I'm not out here telling you don't drill for oil. I'm telling you, you need to drill for more oil. And you people that are standing in line for free handouts of food, you don't need to stand in line. You need to be out producing your own food. Standing in line and sharing the shortage does not produce one new gallon of gasoline, but drilling a new oil well does. And when you have a shortage of gasoline, it manifests itself in the marketplace in higher prices. You do have a physical shortage of gasoline. You got a physical shortage of oil. And to solve that problem, what you do is you put on import quotas. You tell the Saudi Arabians that they cannot sell oil in the United States for $10 a barrel. And you know why? Because that's what they did in the 1990s. And when they sold oil over here for $10 a barrel, it drove the price of domestic production in this country out of business, because we can't produce oil in this country for $10 a barrel. And at that time, we had 100,000 stripper wells, little guys, just small independent guys producing 17% of the oil in the country was produced by those little stripper wells. When the price of oil went down to $10, these same oil companies went into the Congress and the legislatures and said, if an oil well is not producing, it has to be plugged up. So when you were getting a barrel a week for 10 bucks, it didn't pay. So they closed up the well. Today, that barrel of oil a week would be 52 barrels a year. Out of 100,000 oil wells, that's a lot of oil. And at $100 a barrel, that would be a 17% competitive advantage that those little guys would have over the big guys. And we can't have that for monopoly. So we brought over that cheap oil and drove our domestic oil producers out of business in the same way that we did our tomato industry. See, we had a tomato industry in South Florida and in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. And so we came along and said, you got to pay all these farm workers minimum wage, $5 an hour. Well, okay, but you don't have to pay a minimum wage in Hermosillo, Mexico. And that was great for Walmart, because now Walmart could bring in all the tomatoes they wanted in free trade from Mexico. They brought it into the United States for $2 an hour labor in Hermosillo, while farmers in America had to pay $5 an hour in South Florida. So it put the tomato industry in America out of business, just like it put the oil industry in America out of business. Well, okay. It's the worst possible solution. It's a political solution. caused by voting. Let's hear it for voting. Now, you people are so busy with your princess cruises and so busy, you know, with important things like Oprah and Howard Stern and Judge Judy. And I don't know who in the hell you people are voting for, but whoever it is you're voting for has put these policies into operation in this country. And they have already done it in Australia. I mean, they've already got gun control in Australia. You people have got gun control in England. It's coming to America. The socialists want total control over all of the people. They want to reduce the population of America to feudal serfdom, which is where you were when you were in England in 1743, which is why you came to the New World to start with. All you're looking at here is just turning full circle. That's all. You went from slavery to freedom. Now you're going back to slavery. Now, rationing is just a means by which your government is going to gain control over you. Now, for little guys like us, how do we profit off of the coming rationing? You want to position yourself in a position of production so that you can be producing these scarce commodities for the black market. And next time we'll take up the black market. We'll talk a little about this black market and how wicked and evil and terrible and awful and evil the black market is. But remember this. The black market in Kosovo provided gasoline for $20 a gallon in the heart of the war and coffee for $4 a cup. It's true, the average guy couldn't afford gasoline or coffee, but the black market could supply it for anybody with the money. And remember this, if you can produce it, there will be a demand for it, just like there is today for marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. There's a market for it, whether we like it or not. Hey, I'm running out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio worldwide. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.